John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I'm pretty confident in this speculation that I'm about to make here. If you could whip out a dictionary right now, I'm willing to bet that you are either a student on your way to class or a complete dork, or you're playing Scrabble. We have someone like that on the program later this hour. He is a student of dictionary history. He's a Scrabble master. And I think it's fair to say he's a complete dork. The amazing Stefan Fatsis will be with us to talk about the curious history and future of the Merriam-Webster Unabridged Dictionary of the English Language. And in honor of that, all our conversations this hour will be peppered with thoughts about definitions and word origins. We want to get you involved. What word do you think we should eliminate from the dictionary? We'll be sharing those. From politics to the Oscars and to rock climbers' unbelievable triumph. There is no word for this. I would call it a ginormous, awesomeistic, galactic, mega-epic accomplishment. You can see pictures of it on our website, thetakeaway.org. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But joining me right now to talk politics is Frank Keating, former Republican governor of Oklahoma and president and CEO of the American Bankers Association. Governor Keating, welcome back.
John, thank you very much. And I think we need to run one or both of those guys that conquered Yosemite. Anybody who can do that is a knockout. So that is an incredible achievement, isn't it?
It is. And is this your way of saying, please, Mitt Romney, don't run?
No. I was a Mitt Romney volunteer in a very minor way. Mitt Romney is a wonderful human being. I mean, he really is a sweet spirit, as my Southern Baptist friends say. But in my judgment, and I was not surprised by it, the attitude, the reaction of the people in Oklahoma, I was there this week for the governor's inaugural, their view was, you know, we have to win, we can't lose again, and we need new faces, new ideas, let everybody duke it out, and if Romney's in there, fine, if Romney's not in there, that's fine too, but the more the merrier. They want to see a really scalding primary where the fittest will survive, and I agree, I think that's a pretty good approach.
Now, would you describe Mitt Romney as an also-ran at this point? Is that a definition of Mitt Romney?
Well, I mean, three strikes, you're out, and he has run twice. I know it's true that Ronald Reagan, whom I work for, ran three times. But in Mitt's case, I think there are several things, John, that really have not been shared. John McCain asked me to deal with a lot of the conservative religious figures as he was trying to plow his way through the primary process. Romney is a very enormously bright guy, a very gifted and successful business guy. A lot of the conservative base is suspicious of Massachusetts. Isn't that where Elizabeth Warren's from? But they see Mitt as basically an architect of Obamacare, and they despise Obamacare. And also, there's something that really is searing and embarrassing and bad for America. I'm a Catholic. There really isn't the anti-Catholic bias in politics there used to be. But there is an anti-Mormon bias in politics. And that, I think, is one of the reasons Mitt did not do as well as he thought he would do. It's alive and well out there. And I think that is a factor that he has to contend with.
Well, everyone would say he's a decent fellow, but doesn't he complicate the calculus for the GOP in the sense that he can afford to stay in there for quite a long time? So fundraisers, if they want to support someone who they think is actually a winner, if they believe that Mitt Romney isn't, are going to have to match him dollar for dollar until he just gets sick of it, or it becomes clear that he can't make it, or he wins. He's unlike someone like Governor Christie, who really has to sell himself and get the money, whether you think he can win or not, and he has his own problems.
Well, I think that's a very good point, John. The reality is he can self-fund to a very significant degree. He could put $50 million on the table, say, hey, this is the start. But the reality is once he self-funds, he doesn't want to impoverish himself, but once he self-funds, then he's got to go out and raise money. And I have talked to a lot of the large donor deep pocket group that I am familiar with in in Oklahoma and in the Southwest. They like Mitt Romney, but they are of the view that he's had his day. And let's look at some of these other people. And there are some, I think, pretty good folks. I did a review of Scott Walker's book for the Washington Times some months ago. I couldn't believe the courage that guy had. Jeb Bush has been a friend of mine forever. He is humble, bright, decent. He's the best of the best of the Bushes, in my opinion. Obviously, there's a second-tier group of candidates. Chris Christie's one. Certainly, Kasich in Ohio, the governor there, or Mike Pence from Indiana, who are very gifted leaders. They've done things. They've accomplished things. People just simply, in the Republican side, don't want to make the same mistake we made as a country, in their view, 8 years ago. They don't want another professor. They don't want somebody who will diddle and dawdle. They want conservative leadership, strong foreign policy, tax reform, strong economy. This should be America's century, not China's. And that's
all right. Well, then let me help you out here. I'm looking at the whiteboard and I'm seeing these various tiers. Scott Walker, okay, I think he qualifies as fresh to a certain extent. But if the GOP is saying no more Mitt Romney, we got to do something fresh. Is Jeb Bush really an alternative to that? And the other alternative, Chris Christie, who I think has a lot of judgment issues that he's going to have to face in the primary. And then you've got Rand Paul, who, yeah, he's fresh, but I don't know, fresh for, you know, maybe people on Mars in a certain respect. And then you've also got Ted Cruz, who is certainly a powerful speaker, a credentialed conservative, but I think he's going to turn a lot of people off.
But John, I think a number of those folks will drop out early because they don't have the ability to fund. And the reality is, I don't think Republicans are libertarians. Republicans want government to work. They don't want to blow it up. And so I'm not sure about the libertarian side. And obviously, Chris Christie in flyover country, he's very aggressive. That simply won't sell well in many parts of the country, including, for example, my state. But again, I think it's very healthy to have a complete catfight in a primary to find the best, the brightest, the strongest, the survivor. I think people want to see that kind of primary, that kind of campaign, because the Democrats are going to canonize and coronate Hillary Clinton, apparently, and that, to most people, puts the spotlight solely on the Republicans, and I think that's healthy for Republicans.
Frank Keating, always great to talk to you, former Republican governor of Oklahoma and president and CEO of the American Bankers Association. Thanks so much.
Yes, indeed.
If Mitt Romney meets the definition of an also-ran, who meets the definition of a has-been, or the definition of a trusted, loyal friend?
I think this is the most fundamental struggle of our time, and there is only one place to be, which is in the thick of it, and trying to sort it out. And, you know, yeah, of course we can get out, we can be a medium-sized country that sort of hides itself away at the back and doesn't push itself forward and says to America, well, if you really think there's a problem, you go and sort it out. That's not what I want for my country. It's not what I believe the world should be like.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair, proudly speaking of his decision to support the U.S. invasion of Iraq and appointing himself something of a cheerleader-in-chief of the entire Iraq operation. And that's something that over time that has become appalling to British citizens. And there is still unfinished business when it comes to the confused legacy of post-PM Blair. Business that may put Tony Blair further in what meets the definition of the doghouse in terms of popularity in the UK right now. The report, known as the Chilcot Inquiry, contains information about whether the former prime minister made secret promises to former U.S. President George W. Bush in the lead-up to the Iraq War. Promises that may implicate Blair in the support of torture and other interrogation techniques that have already been revealed in the United States with major repercussions for the troubled Bush legacy. We're joined now by Anne McElvoy, economist, public policy editor. Anne, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, John.
So this week we've got David Cameron meeting with Barack Obama. We've got Tony Blair speaking at a panel off in Pennsylvania. How much pressure is there to release this information in the UK, and will it have implications on both sides of the Atlantic?
Well, I think the pressure has mounted as the delays to the so-called Chilcot report have gone on and on, because, of course, this pertains mainly to the invasion of Iraq, goes back to 2003, and all these years later, We've had various inquiries along the way, but this was intended to be the granddaddy of them all, and it's just been delayed and delayed and delayed. So I think there's an awful lot of suppressed expectation there and a feeling that this one really does have to bring out things that the other ones didn't. Otherwise, what have we been waiting for?
And there's certainly a degree of regret in Tony Blair's remarks in trying to explain what he may or may not have agreed to back in that period of 2003. Here's Tony Blair speaking in an interview with the BBC in 2007.
Whatever it began as, it is part of this wider struggle today. And if there's anything I regret about this period, it is I regret not having laid out for people in a clearer way what I saw as the profound nature of this struggle and the fact that it was going to go on for a generation.
Is that really what he regrets here? And will these letters show actually that he regrets something much more specific?
Well, I don't think Tony Blair, I've interviewed very recently for The Economist, I don't think he regrets in the sense that his enemies want him to regret, as in he is not trying to hide the fact that he's sorry, because he isn't sorry. So I think what he's trying to say there in the clip that you played, and also what he said to me very recently, is that he sees the whole Iraq adventure, misadventure, whatever you might like to call it, as part of this whole problem that the world had dealing with post-9/11 conditions and how we were to go about dealing with fundamentalism, about failed states, about people like Saddam Hussein who flouted the international will. Now, for many people, the war doesn't look like it was the right answer. But I think what he's saying is this was part of a context for all leading countries in the world. And unless you understand that, you're just going to say, well, that was a disaster. Why did you do that? You know, slap some sort of punishment or just bad opinion on Tony Blair and carry on as before.
What is the chance that these letters will pull him down from this high-minded, you know, we had a very difficult time and we had to get through it and all of that language, and basically show him admitting that he was willing to pay a price for all that that involved the torture of individuals?
Well, first, I don't know that he will concede that. I mean, I really don't feel able to sign up to that. I think what he will say is that if you take the context of the letters, they never look particularly good, I would suggest, knowing what we know now about what happened in terms of, you know, the forfeiture of some rights, about Guantanamo, about extraterritorial questioning and possible torture of suspects. I think that is a difficult area for him, because the impression I think the letters are likely to give is that he suggested that pretty much whatever the Bush administration did was all right by him.
Anne McElvoy is public policy editor for The Economist. Thanks so much, Anne.
Okay, thank you, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Okay, definition of the word awesome. That's easy. Rock climber Tommy Caldwell and rock climber Kevin Jorgensen. Definition of insane. Again, Tommy Caldwell, Kevin Jorgensen. Definition of Caldwell and Jorgensen today, conquerors of the bomb-proof rock El Capitan's Dawn Wall at Yosemite in Yosemite National Park in California. Definition of jaw-dropping amazed, that is me today. To tell us about the first ascent of the 3,000-foot rock face in a single expedition of free climbing, pictures of which you can see on our website, thetakeaway.org, and they're amazing, is Tim Neville, experienced climber, correspondent for Outside Magazine, joins us from Oregon. Tim, is your jaw off the floor yet?
I think it is, like a lot of people in the country today.
It's pretty amazing what they've done. Describe just what it takes to do this as a free climb, how long it takes, and how you survive just basically clinging to a smooth rock face.
Well, I think we're still grappling with exactly what this means and how they did that. You know, you're talking about 32 pitches. These are rope lengths going up a very steep, almost featureless rock face for 3,000 feet. It's actually the climbing that they had to do is actually more than 3,000 vertical feet, because if you noticed, sometimes they're climbing down, sometimes they're climbing sideways. So they actually ended up doing a lot more than just that. And so to do this, though, that's really the remarkable thing, because, you know, normally to climb up El Cap, you do what's called aid climbing, which means the features of the rock are so small that the human hand is physically incapable of grasping them. And so instead what you do is you use different pieces of equipment to hold on to the rock for you, and then you hold on to that equipment, and that's how you go up.
Things but you cram into the cracks of the wall, right?
Exactly, yeah. Or you drape them over little features on, you know, little ledges and things like that. These guys used only their hands and feet to do that. Now, they still had ropes, of course, because they would fall, and they did fall, and they don't want to die, of course. But just the fact that they're able to move up this thing on their own is pretty incredible.
Now, I'm surprised that El Capitan is not festooned with weird little pitons and climbing devices from decades and decades of people trying to get up this thing.
Well, there are what they call pin scars up there, and there is a bunch of old gear that is still stuck into the cracks. You know, but ethics changed over time. You know, back in 1958, people looked at this and they thought, there's no way that anybody can ever climb this ever. And so, you know, Warren Harding and his crew figured out a way to do it, and it took them 17 months to do it. But they had to use gear that, you know, they had to leave permanently in the rock. And since we've been able to get a lot of that old equipment out now. And so, you know, ethics have changed, the sport, the technology, honestly, has changed. And what we can do as humans, people have continually pushed that bound. And that's exactly what those guys did, you know, over the past 2.5 weeks.
When you're face to face with Tommy Caldwell, actually, I know you've interviewed him. I don't know if you've been face to face with him, but if you are face to face with him, what do you see in his eyes, in the manner of which, you know, the manner he speaks, and his hands that says he's different from me or you?
Well, first of all, you know, speaking with Tommy, you know, you see just a very happy guy. I mean, here's somebody who is doing exactly what he wants to do. And, you know, how many of us really get to do that? And I mean, he's a climber. So he's going to these beautiful places. And you can tell just by the way he speaks that he has this enormous amount of love for what he does and for these places. And it tends to rub off on you. You know, he's obviously built like a climber. He's got enormous upper body, you know, shoulders, and then these tiny little legs that are just dangle from them. He looks sort of like a Y, I guess you could say. But what's really interesting, and something that you don't see unless you look really closely when he's climbing, is that he only has 9.5 fingers, which in climbing really means only 9 fingers. He ended up accidentally chopping off his left index finger working on with a table saw. So, you know.
Of course he did. I mean, of course. Yeah. Why would you want to do it with 10 fingers? I mean, there's no challenge in that.
Right.
Oh, my God. That is
insane. You know, something else I just want to say real quick. Something else, you know, the calluses also on his fingers are also pretty amazing, because when you're holding onto these tiny little nubs of very sharp rock, you know, I mean, that was the big thing here. It's like you could be as strong as you could be Superman, but if the little pads on your fingers won't stick to the rock, then it's all for nothing. And so they really work on trying to develop calluses on their fingers. Now, Tommy's, when I spoke to him some time ago, Tommy was telling me that his calluses had gotten so thick and so burly that, you know, he couldn't physically pick up a quarter off of a table.
Oh my God.
But he could grab a hot beaker off of a Bunsen burner with his bare hands, no problem.
Oh, geez. I could talk with you for like an hour, Tim. Let's describe the map that these guys have to have in their brain of every little feature on that face to know where they are and where they have to get to.
Yeah, that's true. So, you know, climbers always talk about sequences and unlocking sequences. And that's one of the big appeals, honestly, of climbing is, you know, being presented with what they even call problems. Okay, I've got this little hold here that I can only pull this way, and I can maybe get a foot on that. I can hold onto this if I push that way. And so, when you're climbing at the level that these guys are climbing at, there's really only one way to unlock that sequence. And so, you know, they've gone back and they've worked sections of this route over and over and to memorize these sequences. Now you look, you know, and this kind of came to a head during the climb there, you know, on pitch 15 with Kevin. And Kevin is you listen to him speak it, and I'm almost sure you could ask him, so how does pitch, you know, 12 unfold? And he could tell you exactly how the moves go. Now, pitch 15, this is one that kind of like, you know, this was a breaking point in the climb, I think, for him, because, you know, it was so technical and there was only one way to do it that, you know, it took him 11 tries over 7 days to finally be able to get through this one section. And, you know, and I'm sorry, I don't know exactly how long it is, but it couldn't have been more than 60 feet.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Do you have one word for what they did before we go?
Inspiring.
Inspiring.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
Inspiring.
Tim Neville, experienced climber and correspondent for Outside Magazine, who's interviewed Tommy Caldwell, the most experienced member of the El Capitan team. Tommy Caldwell and Kevin Jorgensen have conquered the Dawn Wall at Yosemite. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings, legal plans featuring attorney contract review, and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Definition of glamorous, the Academy Awards. Definition of pointless, the Academy Awards again. Definition of backstabbing political nightmare, the Academy Awards. And the nominations for the 87th Academy Awards are out. And Kristen Meinzer of the Takeaway podcast, the Movie Date podcast, is here with us. Kristen, welcome.
Hi, John.
This is it. Look at that big smile on
your
face.
You know I love Oscar season. I'm crazy about Oscar season.
All right, let's go through this list as best we can. Best Picture?
Well, for Best Picture, you know, we have some surprises. We have, first and foremost, something that I have to point out here is that who led in the nominations? Grand Budapest Hotel and Birdman tied with 9 nominations each.
Well, so, Birdman is an emotional sort of Michael Keaton redemption vote, I would think. But Grand Budapest Hotel,
yes,
that's amazing.
Isn't that a big surprise? Okay, so the Best Picture nominations, American Sniper, Birdman, Boyhood, Grand Budapest Hotel, Imitation Game, Selma, The Theory of Everything, and Whiplash. And, I mean, they're all great nominations, but I'm just so surprised that Grand Budapest Hotel is leading in nominations. It was an adorable film that did well many, many months ago, and I think a lot of people are shocked that it has 9 nominations this year.
Actress?
So for actress, we have a nice variety of actresses this year, and I think a lot of people would be surprised by who we have. It includes Marion Cotillard for 2 Days, 1 Night. She's terrific in that movie, but
so fantastic.
It's a French-speaking role. Felicity Jones in Theory of Everything. Julianne Moore in Still Alice, which I think that's very well-deserved. Rosamund Pike, I think some people are surprised by. Gone
that's
Girl.
Surprising, yeah.
And Reese Witherspoon for Wild, another surprise as a backpacker.
Yeah, the actress list is very different from what happened at the Golden Globes, it seems to be. What about actor?
Yeah, so for actor, I'm very surprised by actor, actually. We have Steve Carell for Foxcatcher, which well-deserved, I think.
Well-deserved, yeah.
Bradley Cooper for American Sniper, which I think some people are surprised by. Benedict Cumberbatch for The Imitation Game.
That's
Michael Keaton for Birdman. And Eddie Redmayne for The Theory of Everything. Not surprising at all. He's just terrific in The Theory of Everything.
It's got to be Keaton. Got to be Keaton, right?
You think so?
Well,
I think a lot of people think it's going to be Eddie Redmayne because, you know, it's a tough role playing Stephen Hawking.
Let's do directing.
All right. So for directing, Birdman, Boyhood, Foxcatcher, again, Grand Budapest Hotel making another appearance here, and The Imitation Game. And no Selma there. No Selma on the list.
This has got to be a fight between Boyhood and Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yes, and it's such an odd fight. Again, Grand Budapest. How is this leading? And yet Selma isn't – I mean, Selma got 2 nods. This is – just outrageous to me. I'm really shocked by that.
Looking at the actress in a supporting role, will we see Patricia Arquette doing that tearful acceptance speech like we saw at the Golden Globes? Or will it be Meryl Streep up there for the 100,000th time?
Well, it's quite a pool. Emma Stone also for Birdman, Keira Knightley for The Imitation Game, Laura Dern for Wild. She's terrific in Wild. But I think you're right. It's going to be Patricia Arquette.
And what about writing, the sort of, you know, cinematography, the alternate Best Picture awards?
Oh, all those awards. You know, again, lots of Grand Budapest all over those categories. And unfortunately, you know, every year you also get the expected, but then you also get lots of shutouts. And I just need to point out a couple things that are snubs here before we go. We only have a few seconds left.
A lot of
left.
Snubs for Selma.
Yeah, not just the snubs for Selma, but the Lego Movie did not get a Best Animated Feature nod.
That's crazy.
Isn't that crazy?
That's crazy.
I know you loved that movie.
Definition of crazy.
It got a Best Original Song nomination for Everything is Awesome. But, You know, David Ayelowo, again, not getting a nomination for Selma, very surprising. And I think some people expected Jennifer Aniston to get a nomination for Cake for Best Actress, and I think she kind of deserved it. It's a great movie.
People don't like her in Hollywood. I don't know. I have no idea.
Maybe she's too likable. Maybe that's it.
Well, Kristen Meinzer is certainly likable. Culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast on all the Oscar nominations for the 87th Oscars. When are they?
They are February 22nd. Can't wait.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
In the year 1220, because of an English gentleman named John of Garland, you could finally look up a word in the dictionary. It was called the dictionarium, or dictionarius, and it was a guide to Latin. Latin, where dictionarium meant of or about speaking words, hence diction, hence dictionary, the modern definition of which is
a reference book that lists in alphabetical order words that relate to a particular subject along with their definitions and uses.
I suppose we could also imagine this definition in the distant future. Dictionary, a weird book full of words from before the internet. Well, it turns out that Webster, the name that is synonymous with dictionary, hey, a court ruled that a long time ago. Webster means dictionary. The Merriam-Webster Company is saying goodbye to print. The first complete overhaul of its unabridged dictionary since 1961 will live entirely online. A database for word freaks, to be sure. And Stefan Fatsis is one of those. He's the author of the book Word Freak about the subculture of Scrabble. He takes a heroic look in Slate at Webster's, the longstanding authority for settling arguments over words in American English, and a dictionary publisher that seems to have survived the internet.
Merriam-Webster is the last American dictionary company left, last full-throated, fully staffed dictionary company left. I mean, the last 20 years in the dictionary business have been a gradual decline. There have been Random House, American Heritage, the big dictionary names that we're familiar with, they've all just allowed their staffs to wither. American Heritage has four lexicographers working full-time. Merriam-Webster has about 40 people on its editorial staff. So they are the sort of the last flag carriers for what has been an industry in decline.
And your piece tells the story, and you know, there's a big story here of just how dictionaries are a moving target in terms of mm-hmm. what they are, in terms of what a lexicographer is, that goes back way before Webster. That's what the Oxford English Dictionary was sure. and still is, and is a part of this new internet trend.
Absolutely.
How does that work?
If you go back and look at the origins of sort of the mainstream dictionary, Samuel Johnson's dictionary, the British dictionary, is really the first major dictionary. That was accumulated. The OED was put together largely through crowdsourcing. Mm-hmm. He put out a call for the public to contribute examples of words and mail them in. Simon Winchester's book, The Professor and the Madman. The madman in that book was a citizen who was a prolific provider of what are called citations for the dictionary.
A lexicographer who was more like a crossword puzzle hobbyist than he was some sort of systematic scientific or literary writer.
Absolutely. And what that demonstrates is that lexicography, the study of words and the creation of definitions defining words, is something that is imbued in culture. It's imbued in the public. We all are curious about where words come from and what they mean. How we get to the point where somebody codifies what a definition is, that's become a profession in the last 200 plus years. Noah Webster's first dictionary was 1806. And the reason we care about Webster, too, is that he was the first American lexicographer. I mean, his 1828 dictionary was sort of this monument. It was considered the best dictionary since Johnson. It was certainly the American dictionary. And in that, that's where the sort of this tradition and the scholarship stems from. And that's why Merriam-Webster is at the forefront of trying to figure out what to do with lexicography in the digital age. How does this change and what do we do going forward?
Would you say this is an attempt by Webster to update dictionaries, or is it more, which is a bigger idea, they think dictionaries rightfully belong in this online cultural wash?
Well, as the president of Merriam-Webster, John Morris, told me, he said, we are primarily a digital company now. They generate more revenue from online advertising and subscriptions to the unabridged dictionary, which is the focus of their change and their efforts, which we can talk about a little bit, than they do from selling books. and Moore said to me that a dictionary is a database. It's not a book anymore. And he's comfortable with that. There isn't so much nostalgia inside Merriam-Webster for the idea of the print book. Look, print books are still going to sell because there's a good margin and people want them. And some books are very desirable, paperbacks, learner's dictionaries. I mean, some things are just, they're going to continue to sell.
Student stuff.
Sure, yeah, student right. stuff. So we're not going to get rid of the print book. But at the same time, there is so much more that lexicographers can do online that it's actually an incredibly vibrant and exciting time for the study and the future of words.
Well, you got a sense of that by being in their offices. Let's get a sense of it online here. If I'm going to type in a Google search of definition of some word,
you don't even
and
do
you're
that,
a, you're
John.
A Scrabble.
Just type in
nerd.
A word.
All right, type in a word. I'll type in a word. What's a good one? You're the Scrabble guy here. Let's it's something kind of challenging.
Well, how about ubiquitous? That's one of the most looked up words on Merriam-Webster's free dictionary, which is based on its college dictionary, the Collegiate.
All right, I spelled it wrong, of course. I just have an extra O in there, but I think I got it right now. Ubiquitous. A Google definition comes up,
yeah,
and
Google
the third reference is ubiquitous Merriam-Webster online.
Right.
They're pretty good.
This is all about search engine optimization. It's not about URLs anymore. In the mid-90s, Merriam looked into acquiring dictionary.com, and when they looked into it, they discovered that two guys had acquired it 6 weeks before
Oops.
They did. Oops. For the first few years of the internet age, that was important because people typed in dictionary to get to one, and dictionary.com would often come up first. Then, as people became more sophisticated in how we use the internet, they would just type in the word. They type in ubiquitous. So it becomes a question of whose website is going to pop up first, whose link is going to pop up first.
That's a big sort of cognitive shift. You go from, I need a dictionary, which is a book, but it can also be, I need the dictionary, which is in Microsoft Word, mm-hmm. which is a Microsoft product, to, I think of the internet as a dictionary.
Right.
I don't need a dictionary. I always have a dictionary, so it's just about a search.
That is exactly the challenge that Merriam-Webster and American Heritage and the OED and everybody is facing in this industry. How do we persuade people that they still need the expertise, that they still need the cachet, that they still want to turn to this trusted name in lexicography, Merriam-Webster in this case? For some lexicographers, the answer is they don't. I interviewed a woman named Erin McKean, who has started an online dictionary called WordNik. And the idea there is that everything should be crowdsourced.
And like, she used to be with Oxford.
She did. So she comes from mainstream lexicography. But her view now is that everything is a word. We don't need curators. We need the public. We need this crowdsourced groupthink on what a word is. I don't need someone at Merriam to take 10 years or 5 years or 3 years to determine that based on the number of citations of a particular word in print, it rises to the level that now we can affirm that it belongs in this collection that we call a dictionary.
Which takes us away completely from the Samuel Johnson idea. We're trying to get a snapshot of a static language.
Correct.
To preserve everyone's spelling and literacy. To now, when you ask for a definition, you don't want the answer. You want to start an argument about what the definition is.
Correct. So the challenge for Merriam then is how do we make the public want to search us out and trust us? And the answer partly is that people do want that authority. They do want the answer. I mean, there's this monolithic idea of the dictionary in quotes. I mean, there are lots of different dictionaries. The trick for publishers like Merriam is going to be how do we find the sweet spot between Noah Webster and the rigid formulation of what a dictionary definition is and the sort of lexicographic free-for-all of something like Urban Dictionary or Wiktionary or any sort of aggregation online. At the same time, there's really exciting possibility and potential for how you can harness the power of the internet and these giant corpuses of words and language to make dictionaries better, to redefine them.
Thinking about changing dictionaries in the 21st century, don't have an argument with him about a Scrabble entry. Stefan Fatsis is author of Word Freak, a book about the subculture of Scrabble. His profile of Merriam-Webster and what's going on with dictionaries is in Slate. Thanks so much, Stefan.
Thank you, John.
So who wants the last word on this dictionary business?
Closure, I think, is a word that needs to be taken out of the dictionary because it's just useless.
You can try and top that at 8778MyTaker. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway, or you can experience it all in full fidelity MP3 audio splendor at thetakeaway.org. Thanks for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.